Hi, I'm Stanley Goldberg, host of the Inquiring Mind podcast. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you're new here, I release 2 episodes a week with a variety of fascinating guests, and I would appreciate if you would support my podcast by liking this video and subscribing down below. Thank you for your support, and now to today's guest. Amity Schles, welcome to the Inquiring Mind podcast.
Glad to be here.
Before we get into your books, I have them right in front of me. This is only going to be available on audio, but I will mention them. It's The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. Most recently, Great Society, A New History. I know you also wrote a book on Coolidge and others in the past. But before we get into all of that, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. I like Inquiring Minds. Inquiry is the joy of life. When inquiry stops, life stops being fun. I started out as a journalist. I was always interested in economics, partly because I worked in Europe when half of Europe was still communist. So I got in real time to observe what happens in socialist, tyrannically managed economies. And I was able to witness the liberation of Europe in 1989. So I, as a journalist, over and over again, econ was the part of life that seemed interesting to me. And I wrote a number of books and eventually came to focus on the Great Depression and wrote a book called Forgotten Man about the Great Depression. And then I wrote this sort of prequel, which is about the 20s. The Forgotten Man was how the government made things worse in the economy in the 30s and broke it, that is the economy. So what was the it that was broken? What was an economy that worked? That was the 20s. So I went back and wrote this prequel book in the biography of Coolidge. I could have as well called the Coolidge book The 20s or The Roar, but it just happened. I ended up focusing on the man. More recently, I looked at the sequel to the 30s and the New Deal, which is Johnson's Great Society, and wrote a book about that called Great Society. It could have been called Silent Majority, but for various reasons, we called it Great Society. And it's about, it basically traces the interventions of the 1960s, the optimism of the 1960s, the idealism of the 1960s, and the concept of great. So that's all very relevant to today. In that book, I basically say everyone wants to get to great, as now great is an inspiring goal. The only question was, at that time, when do we get to great through the public sector or the private sector? Who gets to the moon, right? And by and large, we opted for the public sector to try to get to great, and that didn't work out very well. And the private sector was slogging along towards its own greatness, and it did better than we know. So in the Great Society book, I cover private companies and government endeavors.
Wonderful.
With the conclusion that the private sector did better than they thought and the public sector did less well than we thought.
In the Great Society, in the beginning of the book, you have a quote, "Nothing is new, it is just forgotten." And much like the New Deal, and the same could be said for the Great Society, why do we seem to forget and repeat the mistakes of the past?
I don't know. You can say, in the Great Society book, I did not focus too much on education. That's a hard topic. I probably should have, because the Great Society gave us a whole new culture of education through laws, through public sector unions, through curricula, and through the long march of left intellectuals through the institutions. You've heard that phrase. Which comes from Gramsci or from the German revolutionary Rudi Dutschke, that we're gonna have a revolution through the institutions and a long march there. We're gonna be like Mao, but not in a military war, rather in a long march like Mao's, but through institutions till we come to lead institutions and can convey our thoughts to our constituents, which would then be students, high schoolers, college students. That actually occurred, so that the academy is far to the left of where it was in the leftish 60s, for example. And I should have covered that more. And that group, that is to say the progressive academy, likes progressive ideas. So the progressive academy wants to forget the less than optimal outcomes of a progressive venture, which was the Great Society. It would rather emphasize the fun of the idealism. But nostalgia is not a policy, right? Just because you love something and it inspires you doesn't mean you should replicate it. We're also a casualty of our own success. Every time, sort of out of a sense of fairness, we become richer as a country, we tend to want to do something for others. And the sort of obvious way to do that is through economic redistribution, through funding others. And then always that funding seems to go through the public sector, not the private sector.
Yeah. Also, I think early on in your book, you also mentioned the fact that there are three incorrect ways of teaching this time period. And I'm sorry if I can't recall all of them off the top of my head, but all three versions kind of distort the way we teach the Great Society and the period around it. Do you believe we teach history well in the United States? And if not, what can we do to kind of remedy that?
I don't believe we teach history well. We teach history poorly. However, teachers alone, you know, what usually follows such a statement is, and teachers are bad and evil, and they're on the long march. I don't think teachers alone are to blame. We're all caught up. I just did a review of AP history texts for the National Association of Scholars to try and figure out what history kids are learning. Actually standard texts for standard courses and AP advanced placement texts for secondary school. And if you read those books, what you come away with is not that they're all left wing, though they lean progressive in a distorting way, but that they're absolutely incoherent. There's no storyline. They're just like sort of spam of knowledge, spamming at the poor 16-year-old. So he's got a whole lot of facts in him and not much narrative. I think because the textbooks are written by committee, that doesn't usually work. Stories should be written by one person and are constantly covering bases. Oh yeah, we have to get this event from 1972 in. Oh yeah, we forgot that. So it's kind of like a bad legal document, history. You think of a bad legal document, you could barely read it, or a bad law, because so many edits have been made. That's what history texts are like. And that's also a function, it's a function of fear, of writing by committee. And it's also a function of the infatuation with tech, because a lot of these books take great pains, I'm talking here about secondary school, to be multimedia, part of a multimedia venture. So they say, see the video, right? Download the software, download the app, download the, do the interactive problem set, all that with history. And the poor student, again, spends a too great a share of the hour he gives to history, say some nights for homework, dealing with technology and flipping among media. That's actually why I like radio or a show like yours. Radio is pretty sparse, pretty minimalist. You're cutting out the visual. And when you cut out the visual, you give the mind a chance to concentrate. These books are the opposite. Oh my God, visual collage. And then on top of all that, the 60s had a collage culture. It had a kaleidoscope culture. And oh, things came at people. Sometimes they even involved drugs, right? Psychedelic drugs. And the kaleidoscope collage approach was in fashion. People taught thematically, not chronologically. The human brain likes chronology. Thematic is hard for the human brain. So that comes into professors who write textbooks, like to write thematically because it shows how intelligent they are. I find thematic writing hard to take after a while. So not only do we teach history with a left tilt, again, we also teach it incoherently. And that the second is actually the greater sin.
Yeah, I noticed that myself when I was in school. I remember very recently I had a conversation with Ken White, who wrote an amazing biography of Hoover. And I remember thinking for a long time, Hoover bad, FDR good. Those are kind of the ways everything was taught in school. And, you know, the New Deal was a net good for society. FDR was a net good. And Hoover caused the Depression. And then once you start dispelling those myths, you understand that none of that actually made sense to begin with. And what I noticed when reading your book is that our misperceptions of the New Deal actually shaped the gung-ho attitude people had towards accepting the Great Society.
Yeah, they were already forgetting then. I mean, you think about the New Deal, the record of the New Deal is Roosevelt said he was for jobs. He came in. He was a moderate politician, or anyway, an unpredictable politician with some moderate aspects. You know, when Roosevelt came in, not particularly consistent. One thing he was concerned about was cutting the federal budget. And we think of Roosevelt, big spender, right? That was later. So Roosevelt comes in, no one knows what to expect. They know he's a Democrat. He's surrounded by progressive forces. And what is he going to do with his progressive venture, which he does launch, decides to be a progressive, New Deal. It's a huge, unprecedented venture, warranted only by one argument, which is there's an economic emergency and there are not enough jobs and we're going to create jobs. Well, you know what? They didn't. So if you go back and look at the data points, yes, they created some jobs, but net, unemployment was over 10% the whole 30s. We wouldn't live with that. It was really closer to 15. And there's a very ugly fight about the New Deal. It is, was the unemployment average rate 13% or 14%? Or a version of that fight goes, was the unemployment rate 15% or 13.5%? These are silly differences. What we say, nice differences. It's the difference between terrible and awful, 13.5 versus 15. Neither is acceptable. And yet that abided basically throughout the period with certain breaks, that rate of unemployment. So Roosevelt failed. And then you can work backwards and say, oh, but there was so much deflation and you know, that it wasn't his fault. You cannot blame the entire Great Depression on monetary. Even the famous monetarists did not do that. Even Milton Friedman did not do that. If you look closely at his work, the man who invented monetarism. Okay. So there's that essential failure. The job of a big humanitarian or pro-people program is to supply jobs. What's the best thing you can give a person? Not a payment, but a job, particularly an unemployed person. The New Deal didn't do that. And yet that refused to be remembered, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then, so you ask, like, why didn't they remember that? Why didn't they sort of did. That is people in the 50s, particularly when you look at the legislation that happened or didn't happen in the 40s and 50s, some of that reflects a memory of the failures of the New Deal. For example, the Taft-Hartley Act, which essentially neutered the labor centerpiece of the New Deal, the Wagner Act. Truman didn't like it. His veto was overridden. Congress remembered. But people didn't really remember. And I think war has something to do with that. War, it's a sad little fact for economic people that war always trumps econ. Roosevelt was probably a good war leader. Many of us have believed he fought against the terrible Nazis. He showed great courage. He joined with Britain. We negotiated this war. We prosecuted and we beat out the bad people. That's the simple way to put it. Of course, we had some terrible trades. We worked with Stalin, but we won and made Europe safer for democracy. So anyway, that's the argument. If you like Roosevelt in World War II, then you forget about Roosevelt in the 30s. And that is connected to yet another problem, which is we tend to want to lionize presidents. We want kings. And if we say, what a great guy he was in World War II, we don't allow ourselves to say, but he was a pretty rotten economist, which he was. Because that bothers us because he's a hero. So I'm not wild about that hero thing with presidents, because presidents are just guys and gals, well, guys so far. And they have pluses and minuses, and it's not a zero-sum game. Every president has something to offer intellectually, in terms of evidence, in terms of a model. And the fact that Roosevelt was a bad economist shouldn't get in the way of the fact that he was a pretty good admiral president, war president. And I don't know why that is, but it's sort of like sports. We treat the presidency and presidential ranking like sports. Somebody's up, somebody else has to be down. It's a ranking. It's got the brutality of ranking, when ranking presidents doesn't always serve us because they're nuanced guys.
Yeah, but the difficulty, I think, with ranking presidents as well is the fact that there's no context. When you rank somebody that was a peacetime president versus a wartime president, it's almost unfair.
It's unfair because war is always more fun or more inspiring, you know?
Yes.
Unless they lost the war, right?
Correct.
But I think the safe way to judge a president is to judge him most of the time, is to judge him by what he set out to do. Their intervening emergencies, World War II, whatever, you know, Vietnam, I guess. But what did he set out to do? And what did he promise he would do? And then was he able to achieve that? You judge him in his own terms.
Yeah.
Of course, sometimes that's not possible, but it's possible fairly often.
Right. Another fact that was very interesting to me when reading your book is you said that because of the failure of the Great Society, political trust was also diminished in society at large. You write, quote, the political success of a project mattered more than empirical success at the time. And can you describe how was political trust affected by the policies of the Great Society?
Well, you think about metrics, right? And you usually when you're talking about metrics, you count output, outcome, result, different words for it, right? Mm-hmm. But I wanted to bake a cake. Did I bake a cake? I wanted to bake 10 cakes in an afternoon. Did I bake 10 cakes? Where are the 10 cakes? Here's the photo. I baked 10 cakes, right? Someone who considers success just the input, the grandeur of the plan to bake 10 cakes or launch a great society, that doesn't really care about the output in terms of the actual cakes. That's a little bit of a raw way to look at things. So Lyndon Johnson was a person whose strength was getting laws passed. He had been, you know, master of the Senate. He was master of the Senate. So his idea of an achievement was getting a law passed, not what the law's effect was, not whether the law actually achieved what he had said it would do when he advertised it and went to Congress to sell the law, because presidents do have to do that. That was a little disappointing, and that broke political trust. I think the presidency got a bit too big under Johnson, and then Nixon, who was very much like Johnson, surprisingly, when you go back and see. And Americans, what I was trying to get, I think you're remembering from the intro, Americans didn't really like the presidency to be that powerful. And that was one reason Watergate caught on. There are scandals all the time, but only some catch on and have consequences. Watergate caught on. It could have been we ignored Watergate. The way we ignore, say, I don't know, President Grant's excesses and cronyism. We didn't ignore Watergate. And I think it was a resentment of the executive overreach of the period. Mm-hmm. Whether also, you know, in Vietnam. But so you always don't want to ask, what is your metric and do I accept it? Do I accept your metric as a useful metric? If you're going to force this discussion to be about metrics, let's define your metric and be sure I find it useful. One of the people who recognized this and was caught in the middle was Daniel Patrick Moynihan. who was a political advisor to President Johnson and then to President Nixon, he saw the tragedy of using the wrong metrics to pat yourself on the back. Just because something becomes a law doesn't mean it's a good law or achieves the effect, but he didn't quite know what to do about it. And he wrote very articulately about that. So he's sort of, he's, if this were a Shakespeare play, The Great Society, he's the fool who stands on the edge and comments on the disasters, but also participates in the action and even helps to cause the disasters.
Yeah. What's interesting is we like to think of Americans as not wanting big government and not wanting big government action. But at the same time, there is a decent constituency throughout history that kind of yearns for this, the New Deals and the Great Society. And even today, you hear a lot from especially people on the left side of the political aisle that they want a 21st century New Deal. And that sounds really good. I mean, their marketing is top notch. So why for a country that claims to not want so much government, do we actually want so much government?
Maybe it gets back to education. I think we have really thought it through. We're basically, you know, you say, what America do we like? Well, one America we like is Tocqueville's America. We didn't have antibiotics yet, but we had a lot of other things, including very vigorous local communities. That's the America, where the local was the center. Washington was not the center. And most of us forget that the federal government wasn't big than the states and towns until the middle of the New Deal, at least not in peacetime. Federal government would expand for wars. I think younger people just don't realize that it wasn't until 1936 or 38 that the federal government was bigger than the states and the towns. And everyone, and again, this is a problem of teaching, takes the economy for granted. Well, the economy will take care of that. The economy is a delicate thing and it can make choices. In the 30s, the economy made a choice every year. It chose to stay away. It took a look at the recovery. You know, the recovery, anthropomorphize a recovery. It takes a look at the policy landscape and says, you know what, I'm gonna stay out one more year. recovery. Because the policy landscape, the policy environment was just too rough. It was too hard on the economy. For some reason, younger people don't know about that. And it's definitely our fault that we failed to teach them or show them. Many young people nowadays don't work very much because they go straight. Say you go straight from high school to college into an MD, PhD program because you're a genius. You never need work, right? And in the olden days, more Americans worked some way or another in a job, I mean. And so they don't have the experience of what a pay stub looks like, or they don't have the experience of watching a boss's business fail. And so many businesses fail. Businesses are delicate. So they kind of assume, well, the business will pay for that. And some businesses have obscene profits. So I just need to figure out how to get the money out of business or rich people. It's partly just a lack of experience. That's a factor too. Also, Americans have high expectations. If you've never been in the military or done anything else slightly risky, and now younger Americans haven't, you're very afraid of any bad thing that might befall you, and you're not very good at risk analysis. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the olden days, people knew, well, they were going to die, that there was a chance that they could get a fatal disease, that some people they knew, even young people, got fatal diseases, and that they had to evaluate a trade-off every time they went somewhere, a foreign country or into a war. And they would say, well, some people die in a war, but the war is not worth fighting, right? That kind of trade-off is apparently no longer you know, considered in younger minds, they tend to say if one person dies, everything must stop. I mean, that's what happened in the COVID quarantine. The COVID is a terrible disease, but there were trade-offs in decisions about COVID. And because we were unwilling to look at those trade-offs, we kind of, we did a lot of damage to the economy.
Mm-hmm. But I also, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm one of the young people that you're describing earlier. And sometimes it seemed to me when I was in college a few years ago, it's not that young people don't work or don't want to work. It's the fact that there is such a high expectation to get an entry-level job. To get an entry-level job, you have to have a minimum a bachelor's degree. Yes, you can have internships. Yes, you can, if you as some entrepreneurs say, if you grind and you start your own business, obviously everyone could do that. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it is exponentially harder, I think, because...
Oh, yes, absolutely. No, but I think we've done that through school. If we say it's better for you to take AP physics over the summer and you'll get a 5 in AP physics, and that'll help you get into college instead of work somewhere. And your parents are wealthy enough that they don't need you to work somewhere to get your car. It absolutely makes sense, if you can do it, for you to take AP physics. That's logical, but you do lose the opportunity to work and see a company. So we're agreeing on this. That's also a function of success. It turns out we have a society that's very much based on comparative advantage now, and there's a huge advantage to serious knowledge, particularly in sciences, or ability to write. So more school is needed. But I do think young people's separation from the work environment has hurt them and hurt the polity.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I spoke to Warren Treadgold, who's a professor himself, and he writes about education a lot. And we had this disagreement when he said, "Well, people need university. We live in a world that requires you to go to a university." I understand that, but doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. When I was in college, no disrespect to a lot of people that I went to school with, they thought that college was just, you know, a 4-year vacation, and some people just didn't have to go to college. They could have gotten jobs somewhere else in a different, a few decades ago, they would have been working somewhere else and they didn't need to do, they didn't need to go to college. But now we live in a world where everyone has to go to college. And the incentives are so perverse, even though you could just, you know, if you want to learn to code, you can literally do it online. That's the best way to do it because coding is all online. So I'll disagree a little bit with the everyone has to go to college statement, or not everyone has to go to college. I'm sorry, that college is needed in the world like we live in today. I also saw that you mentioned a guaranteed income in your book, and you said that it was a bad idea.
Did I say that?
I believe so, or maybe not.
I didn't. I shed some skeptical light on it. The guaranteed income idea was in the 60s or early 70s. Daniel Patrick Moynihan had it had different names, but one was Family Security Act. And he thought about it, and it was kind of neat. But he couldn't get it through Congress, basically. Nixon said he was for it, but not really. And Nixon didn't have enough support in Congress anyway for this idea. But Moynihan also was running some real-time experiments with guaranteed income. And he noticed that people, in some of those experiments, people work less when they had guaranteed income or were less quick to return to work. You can go back and look at them. They're in his own books. That's about the sum of what I said.
Yeah.
I was basically tracing Moynihan's experiment.
Yeah, I didn't want to put words into your mouth. I just thought maybe it was the wrong word to use by saying that you thought it was a bad idea. But
I think people need to, you want to have a structure where people want to work, and you want to have a structure that helps people in really dire situations. You know, so President Clinton wanted that too. You look at the reforms he was involved with. The real problem in the US is actually that even as we've emphasized credentials, the credential of college, the standards of what we consider, you know, what gets a BA, particularly in the humanities, have dropped. Mm-hmm. So what's really depressing is to see people with BAs who are not able to write a letter that people over 40 consider okay. Know who's right. Maybe the younger people are right. We don't need those letters, but there's that gap, and you get money when you can write a letter that people over 40 consider is okay. Right. So there's that gap. I think the real tragedy beyond the tragedy is what we're calling education. Yes, often we waste time in college and we're too credentialist, but also the credentials we get are increasingly odd given what we're learning. One of the things that we have at the Coolidge Foundation is a civics initiative for eighth graders. It's a brand new thing called the Coolidge Citizenship Challenge. Tiny, needs money. And the point of it is to let sort of late middle school, junior high, high school kids take a version of the test that naturalizing Americans take. Like, how long does the senator serve? Well, he served 6 years, or she, you know, like that, like a fact test, not a philosophy test by any means. It's a memorizing fact test. And the reason we have that contest is we have become aware that a lot of kids don't get that stuff in school anymore where they used to more often. If you go back and look at, you know, the high school entry tests of a century ago, they were just much tougher. There were high school entry tests, by the way, often. So I believe that most people can do this work. And this contest is going to be really fun. I believe most everyone can learn most things you learn in high school. Maybe not BC calculus, but everything else. I don't think I could learn BC calculus. But just about everything else. Maybe they'll learn it more slowly. Maybe they have to learn it differently, but they can learn it. And yet we've kind of abdicated even in high school. So you get kids high school, college, way underprepared relative to the past. And then they come out and they're very angry because, and legitimately so, they have a bunch of degrees, but they can't do stuff that is clearly needed in serious work.
Yeah, completely agree with you. I know in the interest of time, I want to ask two questions that I ask of all my guests at the end of every podcast, and you can answer them in whatever order you please. The first one is, if you have any hope, I'm sure you do, what gives you hope for the future? And the second question is, what are five books, fiction, nonfiction, that you would recommend to people?
Oh my God, five books is hard. So I'm just going to look on my shelf. One is, I'll do that first. Is Calvin Coolidge's autobiography, which we just, at the Coolidge Foundation, just had the honor to republish with the publisher ISI. Thank you, Coolidge family descendants, for helping us with that. And in it, there's a wonderful essay by Governor, for those of you interested in Tocqueville, by Governor Jim Douglas, who is one of our, he's the actually a trustee on our Coolidge Fund. On the gubernatorial presidency, which is to say, how is a governor, when he gets to be president, serve as president versus a senator or some other kind of a person with some other kind of background? There's a lot to say for governors because they've run something difficult before. And Coolidge was a gubernatorial president because he had been governor of the Bay State of Massachusetts. So I really like that book. Calvin Coolidge autobiography, the one with the baseball on the cover. I was just reading a book by George Roche, R-O-C-H-E, long time ago book published, well, maybe even 40 or 50 years ago, Anyway, maybe more recently, but still a long time ago, on the French political philosopher Bastiat. And it's really pretty good. Bastiat is the basis for some of the free market writing in the United States. Henry Hazlitt, who wrote Economics in One Lesson, was a student of Bastiat. Bastiat is a hard name to say and spell, B-A-S-T-I-A-T, but he is the clearest economic writer I've ever met. And this nice bio by George Roche, I completely recommend, and I'd never seen. I got it on eBay. I'm reading Jeffrey Garton's book, Right This Sec, about the Camp David meeting where Nixon and his staff and his Treasury Secretary and the Fed wrote the plans of what's known as the Camp David, shock, the Nixon shock, which included tariffs, wage and price controls, and closing the gold window. And that's really interesting. Let's see, is that three? I'm looking at Reaganland again by Perlstein, which I think is a wonderful book and very interesting for both progressives and conservatives because of the depth of the research. I just read a book by a professor named Jean Yarborough at Bowdoin on Theodore Roosevelt and the American political tradition. That's a little bit more, adds a little value in her analysis of the damage to the economy that Theodore Roosevelt did through his progressive impulse and bursts. And am I up to four or
That's five.
So I'm going to stop, but I want to mention John Kogan's book on entitlement, C-O-G-A-N, The High Cost of Good Intentions, which is a fabulous book, mostly data points on the history of welfare in the United States.
Awesome.
And the other question was, and why am I hopeful? I'm hopeful because everyone is getting interested in Calvin Coolidge, who's a great model for people from both parties.
Awesome. Okay. Amity Schlaes, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and it's a wonderful show.
Thank you.